In the news.
Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government. I'm Eric McDaniel.
And I'm Jim Henson.
Well, we've been off for a week, just enjoying spring break, a little bit of South by Southwest. So, Jim, you got to see President Obama speak?
I got to see the president speak. It was a day-long investment. It's about, I think, the third time I'd seen him, actually.
Oh, wow, okay.
But I guess, I don't know, it makes me like an Obama head or something. I didn't travel anywhere, so. Yeah, no, he was, you know, it was interesting. He made some news by talking about the Apple case at the Justice Department for the first time. You know, receptive crowd, interesting seeing him play technology leaders. It was part of South by Southwest Interactive. So a good time, not almost like going to a rock show.
All right, good. I mean, you got out, did something educational. I binged watched Daredevil. we have two different priorities.
I'm on episode 7.
Okay, you got 6 more to go. It's good. But actually in the news, I don't think my TV watching is actually that important. We still have the primary going on, and so we have results from the Democratic primary. So we see in Arizona that Hillary Clinton won in Arizona. They're still doing the final count, so the delegate count may change a bit. But you see that Bernie Sanders won in Utah, but Hillary Clinton won in Idaho.
One thing I should say is I think I got a slide one of those slides backwards. Mm-hmm. And so Sanders won in Idaho and Utah.
Oh, okay, Idaho,
so
okay.
Yeah. I'm going to take the hit on that. That's late night slide work.
Oh, don't worry about it. I've been there. Now, what's important to note is that the news will say, you know, Bernie won this state, Hillary won this state. It's very important to really understand is that the states are weighted differently. So it's not the same as all, because again, population matters. And that's why, you know, Bernie Sanders could win 2 or 3 states, but still trail Hillary Clinton, or maybe even lose be behind the pace of Hillary Clinton, because the states he won were small, the 2 states he won are small, but the one state that Hillary Clinton won was very large. And that's why the Michigan win was so important, because he won a large state. But if you look at the current delegate count, Hillary Clinton still has, you know, more than a 300 delegate lead. So again, 57% to 43%. So clearly there's a lot of ground that Bernie Sanders needs to make up. And actually some senators have said, you know, go ahead, it's time to throw in the towel, call it quits. And instead of attacking Hillary, start attacking Trump. And so the Democratic Party can get focused on the general election.
Yeah, and I think you've seen some subtle signs from Sanders that, you know, there have always been bounds, many more bounds in the conflict between these two. Sanders has been taking it a little bit easier, I think. I think they realize, you know, they know that there is an outcome here. They can't say that. So that race has been a little bit more bound. But that talk is going to continue to get much more pronounced as Hillary Clinton's delegate count increases. We saw an interesting night on the Republican side. Again, probably a little bit more interesting because that's the way these things have been going in this race. Donald Trump won big in Arizona, not a big surprise given his emphasis on immigration and the way that debate has played out in Arizona. Trump was endorsed by Sheriff Joe Arpaio, as we've discussed in here before. But Ted Cruz then won big in Utah by a very large margin. In the couple of weeks running up to this, Trump had essentially ceded Utah by alienating Mormons. He took a shot at Mitt Romney as being, he questioned whether Romney was a Mormon. In typical Trump style, he was doing it in kind of a joking way. He was trying to say that all the Mormons he knew were smart. And so then he quipped, well, maybe Mitt Romney's not a Mormon, huh? But what really got picked up was just him saying that Romney wasn't a Mormon. I think more importantly for the Trump campaign, Trump's general cultural demeanor has not played well in Utah and has not played well among Mormons. Many Mormons, in fact, do missionary work around the world. And so much of that happens in Latin America. And so Utah in general has not been as prone to the anti-immigrant impulses that Trump has played on so well. So if we go and we look at the general state of that race after last night, then Trump is making progress towards the majority threshold of 1237. Cruz is emerging as the clear alternative, but with a much smaller block of delegates. So Trump at this point near 61%, Cruz at only about 30% of the delegates. Another kind of footnote to last night is that John Kasich won no delegates in any of those contests. And so in many ways, the bloom is off the rose after his big win in Ohio that kind of propelled him back in the race, and Rubio's loss in Florida, which knocked him out. So that kind of wraps up the races in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, Kasich should be bowing out soon. It's really between Trump and Cruz, and I believe they're a bit of a Twitter war right now over, I guess, some attacks on Trump's wife. I don't know if it's necessarily by the Cruz campaign, but by people linked to the Cruz campaign or Cruz supporters. And so this is, you know, this is getting really personal. And the problem is, the longer this plays out, the more this is going to hurt the GOP in the general election, because what you're going to end up doing is alienating a significant number of voters. And so if you have Trump win, you're going to have a bunch of people who are upset about Trump, who don't like who Trump is. If Trump loses, then those people who are supporting Trump will feel that they've been cheated, that the party has cheated them in some way. And so it's going to be, and then there is the threat of a third party attempt.
Yeah, even among Republicans, Trump's negatives are very high. So Trump's numbers on one hand have been moving up. I mean, we've talked in past weeks about how, you know, some of what the Republican elites have been putting their hopes in had been the fact that Trump had not really been hitting 50%. He was seemed stalled for a while between 35 and 40. His numbers are creeping up in these elections as the field thins, but he's still not winning huge majorities. And this really has fueled a whole other round of what we think of as a Stop Trump movement among Republican elites. There was on one hand, there was a very high visibility meeting last weekend end of last week, I guess. Conservatives, Republican elites, media figures, had a big meeting in D.C. trying to figure out how they could either stop Trump or somehow replace him at the convention. Somebody was mentioning that meeting to me, and that was a high visibility meeting. But I think the Republican elites are in a constant state of these conversations right now, and it doesn't really seem to be getting them anywhere.
No, it doesn't. I mean, it's. And then this actually may actually help Trump a bit when he says, look, I'm anti-establishment, and look, the establishment is coming after me. And so when you actually formally see the establishment coming after you, all of a sudden he's no longer paranoid. So this may actually help Trump more than it hurts him. And we'll see how it all plays out.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, he's been masterful at using that opposition as a virtue. I mean, it's something that Ted Cruz had been doing, and Trump is now doing it, has turned it into an art. I think the other thing that really fueled this movement last week was this outbreak of violence at Trump rallies. So we've had a few incidents of protesters being in a Trump rally and then somebody in the crowd essentially punching them out as they're being dragged out. Trump's campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, has kind of manhandled a couple of people, it looks like. Some of that has been captured on video. That's not only fueled the opposition to Trump in the sense that Trump is an unusual kind of character in American politics and potentially a dangerous one. And it's fueled some of the tendency to think of Trump as dangerous in the sense of being a fascist, which kind of brings us to our next topic.
Yeah, I mean, you see the anti-Trump stuff really pick up in Chicago, and then Arizona is probably the worst example of this. But one of the things that's really important coming out of this is where you're seeing this huge negative reaction to Trump, but also the reactions to Bernie Sanders as well, as of really the names and titles being thrown around. So you've seen the discussions of fascist, of socialist, populist, and these are various terms being thrown around. But one of the weird things about it, though, is they're not really defining what the terms are. It's really important that we understand what exactly does it mean to be a socialist, to be a fascist. What does populism mean? What's the difference between a socialist and a communist? Because all these things are kind of being thrown out there, but not really discussed. And that's one of the things we want to highlight right now is, okay, what exactly does it mean to call somebody a socialist or a fascist? And so you know, you can see if you, when one of the things about Trump that people have been talking about is trying to label him as a fascist is they've been, like, somebody was randomly putting up Mussolini quotes and saying that this is, this is Donald Trump said it, and Donald Trump actually retweeted one of them. It was like, oh yeah, yeah, I said that. It's like, no, Mussolini said this. If you're not familiar with who Mussolini was, Mussolini was basically the, I guess, dictator of Italy during World War II. So we talk about the axis of evil. It was under Mussolini's reign. Mussolini was actually killed by the Italian people. And that's why Italy goes from supporting the Nazi Germany to opposing Nazi Germany in the middle of World War II. I'm amazed I actually remember all that. All right, I had good history teachers in high school. But you know, when we're talking about this, one of the first things is we start with socialism. That's what's been really thrown around with Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders actually identified himself as a socialist, specifically a democratic socialist. So socialism is defined as a political and economic theory of social organization that advocates the means of production, distribution, and exchange should be owned or regulated by the community as a whole. So socialism is, in many ways, thinking about co-ops, I guess, things like that, where the community as a whole is part of this. Now, what's very important to understand is that this is different from communism. They're similar, but different. So communism is a political theory derived by from Karl Marx, advocating a class war leading to a society in which all property is publicly owned and each person works and is paid according to their abilities and needs, usually organized under a party-led state. So communism, the real key difference between communism and socialism is communism has a one-party state. And this is where one-party states where we see a lot of oppression, but also a high level of corruption as well in one-party states. Again, as we talked about parties in the state of Texas, when the Democratic Party ruled the state of Texas, there was a great deal of repression, but also a great deal of infighting and corruption amongst the parties. With socialism, democratic socialism, the parties are actually competing with each other to see the direction of the nation. And so, you know, one primary example of a democratic socialist would be Martin Luther King Jr. He was a democratic socialist. If you think of democratic socialist nations, you have the Scandinavian nations, whereas the communist nations would be the former USSR, Cuba, China, North Korea.
And in multi-party states, you have socialist parties that compete in elections with, you know, more conventional conservative, non-socialist, non-leftist parties. Socialism and communism comes out of a more concrete kind of political tradition that, you know, is really concerned with a kind of social justice, equality as a fundamental value. But the way that gets processed in American politics was really shaped by the experience of the Cold War in the United States and, you know, the struggle versus the Soviet Union, which was the preeminent communist state. And it's interesting because the fragments of that era have very much been in the news in this week because President Obama has been in Cuba trying to normalize relationships, in the process of normalizing relationship with one of the last communist party ruled states in the world, Cuba. So Bernie Sanders has thus found himself in a position, even though he described himself as a democratic socialist, of having to distinguish himself from somebody who might, you know, very easily out of old habit, perhaps call him a communist. You've still seen some of that on the right. But even from the left, some Democrats have been worried that were Sanders to get the nomination, the first thing that would happen is that people would be calling him a communist. But let's roll a little sound, as Chuck Todd would say, and have Bernie explain it for himself.
So the next time that you hear me attacked as a socialist, like tomorrow, remember this. I don't believe government should take over, you know, the grocery store down the street or own the means of production. But I do believe that the middle class and the working families of this country, who produce the wealth of this country, deserve a decent standard of living and that their incomes should go up, not down. I do believe in private companies that thrive and invest and grow in America, companies that create jobs here, rather than companies that are shutting down in America and increasing their profits by exploiting low-wage labor abroad. I believe that most Americans can pay lower taxes if hedge fund managers who make billions manipulating the marketplace finally start paying the taxes that they should.
Okay, so Senator Sanders does some lifting for us there. And I feel I better call him Senator Sanders. I kind of called him Bernie. It's a little overly familiar. Like saying I went to see Barry a couple weeks ago. Okay, so, but one of the things that, that Senator Sanders does for us there is he really emphasizes that one of the things that is being distinguished here is the role of the state and how powerful the state is. And he clearly backs away from the communist model of state control of all aspects of society or most of them. Now that brings us to this notion of fascism. And this is a label that's been hurled, frankly, most directly at Donald Trump. Now, the classic model of fascism differs from, as a political concept, from socialism and communism in that it's much less deeply rooted in a particular school of intellectual thought and much more historical artifacts. So when you think about fascism, we don't think as much of an ideology like we do with socialism or with communism. We think more about how a political appeal was grafted onto particular political practices in a historical period. So when we talk about fascism, which is generated really, as Eric was saying, from the first real historical experience in Italy, Nazi Germany, some states in the Balkans, we're talking about political appeals that focus very intensely on narratives of community decline, of national humiliation or national victimhood, and promising remedy through national unity, the focus of energy and purity on a very purely conceived nation and national kind of very ethnic identity in a lot of cases. And of course, for those of you that have even passing familiarity with history, this should remind you, of course, of Nazi Germany. In fascism in practice almost always calls for a mass-based party of committed nationalist militants. And what we mean by that are people that are focused on defending the nation and carrying out the will of the political movement. This is typically very anti-democratic. So in fascist regimes, the leadership and the followers, they abandon democratic liberties and they pursue a kind of internal cleansing and national rejuvenation, usually through the use of violence. And there's a kind of counter-rational and counter-ethical tone to how this happens in these regimes. And then finally, fundamentally, they are led by an authoritarian, often at least presumably charismatic leader. When you look back in history, it's odd to look at people like like Hitler or Mussolini as charismatic per se, but in their time and place, they motivated people, they inspired them, and they led people down a pretty dark path. So fascism has been a term that people have hurled at Donald Trump. The other political concept that we've heard a lot this time, as Eric said earlier, is populism. And populism is a different kind of beast. So populism is similar conceptually to fascism in the sense that when we talk about populism, we're really talking primarily about a political appeal. And this appeal is focused on standing up for the rights and the positions of common people as opposed to the elite or the government. And so we've really seen that, an element of that in both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders in the way that they're appealing to the welfare of the general population. We saw that in the Sanders clip that we heard earlier. With Bernie Sanders, we were talking earlier, it's really focused on struggling against Wall Street and the economic elite. But with Donald Trump, it's much more anti-intellectual. It's about party elites. And it does have a much stronger focus on national identity with, you know, frankly, racial and ethnic overtones, this nativist tone that we've talked about with Trump. So let's hear some sound from Trump, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
We have losers. We have losers. We have people that don't have it. We have people that are morally corrupt. We have people that are selling this country down the drain. Our country is in serious trouble. We don't have victories anymore. We used to have victories. but we don't have them. When was the last time anybody saw us beating, let's say, China in a trade deal? They kill us. I beat China all the time. All the time. When did we beat Japan at anything? They send their cars over by the millions. And what do? When was the last time you saw a Chevrolet in Tokyo? It doesn't exist, folks. They beat us all the time. When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us, at our stupidity. And now they're beating us economically. They are not our friend, believe me. But they're killing us economically. The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems.
Well, I do have an answer for the last time I saw a Chevrolet in Tokyo, Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift. But, I mean, if you see from those two statements, you see the populism, the idea that people are selling America short, but then also this idea of national shame. Like, when is the last time we've won? We're losing. The other countries are laughing at us. And this is a very important theme within this. And so what you have going on is Bernie Sanders. His populism is Wall Street is cheating us. With Donald Trump, it's the world is against us. We need to kind of shore ourselves up. And there has been some very strong kind of anti-immigrant sentiment in the sense that these immigrants are coming in and are ruining the nation. And so, and this is where you're really getting this attack on Trump. But again, there's a very large sentiment of that within the American public. And you know, this is nothing new to the American public of getting people riled up. And a lot of people have kind of compared him to George Wallace in the sense that he's using kind of these ethnic and racial undertones to mobilize support. His populism uses these racial and ethnic overtones to gain support. And people actually argue that like doing this can actually lead to some bad decision making. But also the same thing with Senator Sanders, that by constantly blaming Wall Street, Wall Street's there for a reason. And so while they may do some things we don't dislike, they're not completely evil and completely corrupt. And the idea is, you know, you might need to work with Wall Street as time goes on. So both of them are taking these very strong stances that can lead to greater divisiveness as opposed to actually, you know, solving the problems at hand.
And one thing we should say about populist regimes in other countries and the instances of populism that we've frequently seen in the United States is that there's often not a lot of follow through. And that becomes one of the, you know, and that's an artifact of the fact that, you know, populism isn't rooted in a very concrete political ideology or program. It's all about the appeal. So typically, if you're a populist, once you get in power, the situation looks very differently. And historically, we see populists typically compromising much more in power than we might expect from their rhetoric. And I think, you know, so that's part of what, you know, I think bothers people, particularly more classic conservatives, about populism per se. Now, populism has its roots in different, you know, different places in the country and different places in the world. One interesting thing about Trump very quickly is that he's not the first celebrity populist that we've seen. And that has been one of the things that's been very distinctive about Donald Trump, is that he's populist, but he's a rich guy populist whose appeal was built on a national celebrity that came from television and mass media. Texas had their own populist. The governor of Texas, elected in 1938 and then reelected in 1940, but then ran for Senate and didn't finish out his second term, was a guy named Papio Daniel, who had a radio show and had his own kind of anti-communist populist emphasis. So let's roll sand with on Papio Daniel before we get out of here.
I will not have time on this program to mention any more of our accomplishments, and will say that the record which I have just recited is not mine alone, my friends. For the humble part which I have been privileged to play, I am truly grateful. But the achievement of all things worthwhile in a land like ours is based upon the full and free participation, not of one man alone, nor of a group of men, but of all of our people, or at least a majority of them, living together under the beneficences of a government which they themselves have formed, working together under a system of society which guarantees to each and every one life, liberty, and opportunity. Opportunity to lead, opportunity to succeed, opportunity to attain great happiness. I, as your governor, have been only a symbol representing the desires, ambitions, hopes, and faith of 6.5 million good, honest, and good citizens of Texas who carry in their hearts the treasure of pure, old-fashioned democracy and faith in God.
All right. Now, one of the things we did want to talk about before we close out is the attack in Brussels yesterday. And this has become a very big issue, and this will become part of the campaign issue. Donald Trump and Senator Ted Cruz have both kind of jumped into this, with Senator Ted Cruz calling for, again, the observation of Muslims, increasing that activity, saying, look, you know, I've heard about Islamophobia. I don't care. This is about protecting the nation. We've already heard Donald Trump's statements and kind of basically on Muslims and Islam in relation to the U.S., and he kind of further went into this. And we're going to hear more from Senator Sanders and former Secretary of State Clinton as time goes on in terms of their specific ideas towards this. And so it's going to be a really big pressing issue within the campaign, because you're seeing these attacks in Europe, and it looks like, you know, this may become, people are fearful this may become commonplace in Europe.
Yeah, and in the past, in this campaign cycle, Trump's interest in Trump has spiked, actually, in the wake of his response to Paris and to San Bernardino. It'll be interesting to see if that happens again.
Yeah. So that is all we have for this week. I know we went a little bit long, but hey, we had to make up for lost time. And in closing, I want to say rest in peace to Fife Dog, founding member of a tribe called Quest. We will see you all next week.
Yo, microphone check, 1, 2, what is this? The 5-foot assassin with the roughneck business. I float like gravity, never had a cavity. Got more rhymes than the one that's got family. No need to sweat Arsenio to gain some type of fame. No shame in my game, cause I always be the same. Styles upon styles upon styles is what I have. You wanna just a fifer, but you still don't know the half. I sport New Balance sneakers to avoid an arrow path.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Jim Henson and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.